the veil being solitary and gloomy as death itself. I said in my heart, surely if damned spirits are permitted to visit the earth, this must be their rendezvous, and 2 to 1 I shall see some of them. I therefore observed carefully my retreat, and by several marks on the rocks which formed it, I hoped that, on my emergency, I might be directed to the entrance of the cave, by which alone I could return to the society of mortals. I soon found that my precautions were far from being unnecessary, for I saw, by the feeble light which glimmered in the place, a form most frightful making directly towards me. My heart bounced in my breast with terror, and swift as a hare pressed by sanguine hounds, I ran to my little sanctuary. No sooner had I entered it, but the fiend stalked up to the very door of it. The hair of my head stood upright, the blood ran down my back as cold as Greenland ice, and I looked on myself as a dead man, having often heard of miserable wretches being torn in pieces by talons of merciless infernals. But as the hideous form attempted not to penetrate into the cave, nor seemed at all conscious of my being there, I recovered myself a little, and reviewed it with less apprehension of danger. At length he espied another of his clan, to whom he called, and with whom he held the following dialogue, which made such an impression on my mind, that I afterwards recollected the most part of it, and here present it to the worthy reader. The name of this devil, as I afterwards understood, was Avaro, and that of the other Fastasus. The Dialogues of the Devils, Reverend John McGowan, 1863. McGowan's work was controversial in his time and remains so today because he held nothing back, and many of the dialogues that he recorded were severe and cutting to the Christian Church, the papacy, the priesthood, the Jews, and frankly every living person. One of the greatest gifts of his writings, which shows a similarity to C.S. Lewis's Scrap-Tape Letters, although that book was written as a fiction, is the insight which McGowan provides into the subtlety of temptation and how easily mankind can be led astray. In one of the dialogues between two of the demons, Fastasus and Avaro, the two discuss how intricately they are involved in the fashions of the time and how easy it is to lead women and men into vanity and lust simply by making certain types of clothing fashionable. In the dialogue, each demon claims to be behind the designs of the greatest clothing makers of the day, and they take great pride in taking down so many so easily by so doing. But the dialogues are very detailed and cover every possible sin, most of which seem to be suggested to us as humans by minimizing its import, making those who follow the moral law closely to be prudish, and creating a perception of fun and good times around such acts. Interestingly, in their attacks on the Church, they took prideful credit for the widely utilized system of the day in the Catholic faith regarding the selling of indulgences, which are meant to guarantee the faithful a ticket to heaven through the Catholic Church. The attacks on the Church don't stop there, as they speak openly of their great victory in convincing a certain pope to decry a doctrine of infallibility and, in their words, replacing the one true God with a man. At the time, and probably it could be conceded as being somewhat true in certain Catholic circles today, money was a huge part of the Church. And the devils Avaro and Fastasus brag about their many schemes to lead priests to greed with parishioners of means in order to attain political status in the Church. But the devils, of course, don't stick only to the leaders of faith communities. The dialogues continue on a long rant about the ease with which they've taken so many souls of children by creating laxity in parents, and accusing them with slothfulness in their parenting. Here dwells the parent who spends wastefully what should regularly support his family, so that his children are brought up in the most dissolute and irreligious manner, as a preparative to the most vicious practices. Another sort are very careful to preserve the bodies of their children, by providing diligently for them the necessaries and conveniences of life, as they grow up are careful to preserve them from the highway and the stews, by putting into their hands a business by which to obtain a comfortable livelihood, and after all prove the murderers of their children. For, on the one hand, they restrain them not from bad company, which leads to destruction, company that corrupt the principles, vitiate the conduct, and lead into bad practices, such as Sabbath breaking, gaming, lying, and swearing. In his work, We hear from five demons other than Beelzebub himself, who appears frequently throughout the work, mostly being spoken about by his minions. Each demon has certain charges, vices and destruction for which he is to look after in the world: fastasos, vanity; avaro, false piety; infidelis, infidelity; impiator, impiety; discordans, discordance. The devils speak openly about the events which led to the fall of man, the anger of Beelzebub at the station of man and the rage that built within his heart, an account of the fall. The demon, Fastasus, I have already told you, that as soon as I was born, I obtained full dominion over the adherents of Beelzebub. This taught the angels of the deep, that the only way to seduce innocent beings was to inject my nature into them, and that the seeds of pride being once sown, they could not fail of most abundant fruitfulness. Man was originally created in a holy and happy state, a perfect stranger to those evils which now prevail over, and reign predominant in the natural and moral world. You could not have seen so much as one symptom of pride or covetousness or other vice, either in Adam or Eve, in their primitive state. They loved without unchastity, and enjoyed without uncleanness, nor were they in the least acquainted with the racking torments of jealousy. No anxious thoughts, perplexing fears, nor distracting cares, disturbed their peaceful hearts. Envy, anger, shame, and resentment were strangers to the new created pair, and never set foot in paradise before my arrival there. Their sole delight was to contemplate the beneficence of their God. Our regal, eyed angels, when they saw the noble deportment of man, soon perceived that he was of the same nature, which the Son of God was predestinated to assume, for as some think, he might, out of love to the human nature, appear occasionally to the heavenly hosts in the form of man, for the resisting which decree, they were damned to the depths of ever burning hell. The first discovery Beelzebub made of the blessed situation in which man was created, filled his noble mind with such violent agitations of rage, envy, malice, and pride, that his fury burst beyond all bounds. He stamped and raged in a most tempestuous manner, insomuch that he shook the sable firmament of hell, and brought his confederates to inquire the cause of his anguish. A council thus convened, after the prince had a little recovered from the first shock of transporting rage, he related to them what he had discovered concerning the inhabitants of Eden. Perhaps my favorite part of the dialogues is a profoundly interesting section wherein the demons discuss the events immediately before, during and after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. I'll let it speak for itself, an account of the crucifixion from the perspective of the demonic realms and the demons. By Reverend John McGowan. It should be noted that the reference to the Jewish people in this excerpt is in no way exclusive in the mass of writings by Reverend John McGowan. The demonic dialogues take great pains to excoriate the sins of all, including the Christians, the papacy, the priesthood, the vanities, greed and sins of laypeople, people and everything else underneath the infernal register, which excludes none. Because of the nature of this particular historical event, the Jewish priests played a role, and the Reverend's accountings of the discussions of the demons are biting and very harsh, but in the entirety of the dialogues of the devils, this harshness is not exclusive to the Jews or any one group, but to all under the pain of temptation and sin, which includes us all. The demon, infidelis, it happened in the process of time, our friend Judas found an opportunity to betray him into the hands of the principal priests for the goodly reward of 30 pieces of silver, for even Judas would not serve the devil for nothing. At the same time, my son Slavish Fear, who is a spirit of gigantic stature, fell upon and rooted all his followers, so that none of them remained with him in his last temptations. As soon as Emmanuel was seized and fettered, they led him in triumph to prison and judgment, where our steady friends Hatred and Falsehood were appointed witnesses against him in behalf of the commonwealth. So very hard did they swear against him, that he was brought in guilty, as had been agreed on beforehand. As soon as the jury of priests brought in their verdict, the devil Crudelis, and Pilate, who sat as judge, arose and gave sentence against him, which for its singularity, I shall repeat. 1. That the Jewish ploughers should make their furrows long and deep in his devoted flesh. 2. That his face should be marred with shame and spitting. 3. That his cheek should be bruised by the slavish hand of the barbarous smiter. 4. That he should be delivered over for further torment to those who pluck off the hair. 5. That in point of the greatest contempt, his temples should be torn with a mock crown of piercing thorns. 6. That he should be crushed to the earth beneath the weight of the cross, to which he was to be nailed for execution. 7. That in his extreme torture, he should have no drink, but the sourest vinegar mixed with gall. 8. That in the most barbarous manner which devils, priests, and soldiers could devise, his mangled body should be stretched upon and nailed to the accursed wood. And, 9. As unworthy of either, that he should be lifted up betwixt heaven and earth, a spectacle to devils and men, and there hang till he was dead. As soon as the sentence was denounced, the devil Malevolus cried out, "Away with him, soldiers, away with him, come, let us crucify him. His sentence is by far too mild, away with the varlet to Calvary." So they led him away to crucifixion. At the same time our infernal nobility was struck with amazement, at the seeming power which man had gained over Emmanuel, and great Beelzebub, in the midst of his astonishment, thus addressed his senators, "Once was a memorable time, that we made such an attempt to subvert the government of God by resisting the power of Emmanuel, but great was our defeat, and dismal our overthrow. Our designs were not only frustrated, but we ourselves in the height of our confusion, fiercely hurled from the resplendent summit of primeval glory into the yawning gulf of unfathomable perdition, where we are still reserved in these horrible chains, to the judgment of the great and terrible day." A day, the very thoughts of which make this noble frame of mine to tremble as the quaking asp. But how it comes to pass, I know not. These earth-born sons of ours seem exceedingly to surpass us in power, for I saw Emmanuel stand fettered at their bar, dumb as sheep before their shearers. He opened not his mouth. I am much afraid there is some hidden mystery in it. What is this? My undaunted mind is not wont to misgive me thus. What can this unusual tremor which now invades my heart portend? I hate timidity, and yet I cannot help fearing that this commotion of my intellects is ominous of some event fatal to our interest. I cannot deem it possible that the God of heaven and earth would patiently submit to such indignities, had he not some ends to answer by it, to which we at present are strangers. Often have I prophesied true, but oh! May my prophetic mind be mistaken in its present timorous forebodings. Meanwhile let us, my infernal brethren, harden ourselves in despair, for it is now long since hope took wing and fled from these dreary mansions. Strong in fury and fired with revenge, let us quit ourselves like devils and avowed enemies of righteousness. As for me, I hold it good that we instantly fly to the assistance of our devoted friends the Jews. Having this unexpected opportunity, let us not fail to improve it to the best advantage. Let it not be owing to our negligence, if the state of Emmanuel be not overturned. Let not us have the hell to reflect, that we omitted anything which might tend to promote the interest of darkness. Great Beelzebub finishing here, and his motion being universally approved of, all the legions of reprobate angels, a few excepted, who were left to look after the affairs of the damned, took wing for earth, to assist at so very amazing an execution. Arrived at Calvary, they formed themselves into an invisible ring around the elevated cross, where to their unspeakable astonishment and wonder, hung Emmanuel the Maker of the world, and you may be assured they did not fail, as far as it was in the power of fallen spirits, to torment his oppressed soul. Aye, so successful were we devils, priests, and soldiers that day, that no less was hoped for than a decisive victory over the Son of God. But, how shall I speak it? To the everlasting mortification of the infernal peers, just as Emmanuel was to all appearance ready to expire, on a sudden he exerted his mighty power, seized old Beelzebub and dashed him against the cross, then casting him to the earth, he so bruised the head of the serpent with his heel, that there is great reason to believe he will never recover as long as he lives. It would have grieved the heart of the very Crudelius himself to see the abuse which our great and venerable parents received on that occasion. The demon, Impiator, well, sire, I cannot but think how truly the prophetic mind of Beelzebub foreboded his misfortune. But what were the rest of the chiefs, doing? Why did not all the veterans flee to his assistance? The demon, Infidles, a pertinent question indeed, considering by whom it is made, my son. But I assure you, we were never so greatly mistaken in our days as at that time. For when we thought ourselves sure of the victory, to our sad experience we learned that Emmanuel was strongest in death. For even when he was dying, he laid us all under the most perfect arrest. None of us could take one step, either backward or forward, but as he gave permission, so that being spoiled of all our power, we could not help ourselves, much less the afflicted prince. This done, he cried out with a voice which shook the very foundations of both earth and hell, "It is finished," and was then conveyed by death into an invisible state. This done, once more we thought the day our own. But here I cannot omit that fearful stagnation of nature which happened then, and the set of new preachers which were introduced. For when all under our influence had forsaken Emmanuel, who was betrayed by one, denied by another, and forsaken by all his preachers, the indignant son could not endure that sight, as if angry and ashamed of the proceedings of the sons of men, covered his face with a sable cloud, and denied one smiling ray to delinquent earth whilst his Lord was ignominiously crucified. As if it had been seized with uncommon tremor, the earth itself fell into a fit of violent convulsions, the mountains reeled, the rocks rent, the graves opened, the dead arose, and all to preach the sufferings of the God of nature. An invisible hand rent the veil of the temple, that cloth of extraordinary texture, in twain from the top to the bottom. And a voice was heard to say, "The glory is departed from Israel, and now the most holy place is laid open." Death having conveyed Emmanuel to its lonely mansions, the resolute, though maimed Beelzebub, our great prince, recovered himself as much as was possible, his head being incurably broken, mustered his maimed forces, and went to the assistance of death, if possible to keep Emmanuel fast prisoner in the silent tomb. Nothing doubting, but if this could be, we should render all that he had heretofore done and suffered, null and void. The better to succeed in the important enterprise, we sealed the door of the sepulchre, and set a watch of faithful soldiers instructed by the chief of the Jewish priests, and still to make the security stronger, every fiend did his utmost to impost weights on the buried body of Emmanuel, to prevent his resurrection from the solitary grave. But to our eternal confusion, on the third day of his invisible state, he arose, shook himself from the dust, came to the door of the sepulchre, burst it open, and laid hold on death, who stood as sentinel next to the door of the tomb, trampled him under his feet, and by main force wrenched from him his poisonous sting, that sad repository of all his strength. "This done," he said, "henceforth, monster, hast thou no power over the people for whom I have died?" Then he broke impetuously through all the lines of martial infernals who stood in firm phalanx around the tomb, seized the lately wounded chief, who was very ill with a fever in his mind, arising from his disaster upon Mount Calvary. He took the fiend, the great Beelzebub, chained him to the axle of his chariot, mounted his seat, and rode triumphantly through the gathering crowds of joyful saints, who on golden pinions descended from heaven in solemn strains, "To him they're all, conquering and triumphant Redeemer." Oh my friends! My dear infernals, it must have pierced your hearts with the most poignant sorrow to see him dragged in triumph through all the hosts of saints and angels, who fearless stood in blazing ranks to see the longed, for solemnity, and at the same time to see our beloved friend Death lie gasping for life at the door of the sepulchre. Great was the confusion of the infernal brigades when they saw their principalities spoiled, and Death and Satan so terribly handled, yea, so tremendous was their amazement, that to escape the avenging hand of risen Emmanuel, they retreated even to the nethermost depths of hell, and his scattered disciples again resorted to his erected standard. But the greatest disappointment and consternation was, when we understood that after all our diligence and hazardous exploits, we, with our auxiliary priests, and had done nothing but what the hand and counsel of God had predetermined should be done, that by our seeming victory over Emmanuel, he had forever subdued us under his feet, and that our hatred, envy, and cruelty, were fully recompensed into our own bosoms, now deeper damned than ever. The demon, avarice, our father, these were troubles indeed, such as do not happen every day, but it is not for us to desist from tempting when our designs miscarry. Then should we not act the part of desperados, such as we are? The demon, infidels, our gentlemen, great was the cause of my dismay, for Emmanuel gave such demonstration of his messiahship, that all which was written in the prophets concerning him was exactly fulfilled in his life and death. Yea, so very striking was the evidence that many cried, "Truly this is a just man," and others, "Truly this is the Son of God." Therefore I greatly feared that all the world would become believers in him, and consequently shake off my yoke. But I was much obliged to my good friends, the Jewish clergymen, for their reverences greatly befriended me, and warmly espoused my interest, exerted their utmost power to establish the throne of the great infidels, and to destroy the early seeds of Christianity sown by Emmanuel, and now beginning to grow. Emmanuel, having in opposition to all the powers of darkness, finished the work for which he came down to the earth, he triumphantly ascended to his native heaven, to the primeval embraces of his eternal Father, and assumed all the ensigns of his eternal Father, and assumed all the ensigns of Empyrean glory. Soon after this the high festival of Pentecost drew on, and I as formerly, attended at Jerusalem in the midst of many thousands, who according to the law, came up to worship upon that occasion, not only from Judea, but from nations very remote. I dreaded no harm at the hands of a few illiterate fishermen, having not been informed that any of the rulers, or of the scribes and Pharisees had believed in Jesus, and therefore was at no pains to prevent the multitude coming up to the solemnity as usual. But here was another shock my kingdom sustained, for Peter the fisherman, who so very lately like a dust had impiously denied his Lord with profane oaths, now filled with the Holy Ghost, stood up in the midst, and clearly proved that Jesus was the very Messiah, and upon this occasion played off the heavy artillery of Sinai on the consciences of my people, which was attended with success so fatal to me, that no less than 3,000 were pierced through the heart at once, and fell on the field of action. Now it was that my evil apprehensions were again alarmed, plainly perceiving that the artillery of the word was leveled against my person, and that the first end of the gospel was the subversion of my diabolical government. However, I drew up all the forces which I possibly could in the hurry of that surprise, and had just time to give one general discharge, my soldiers crying out as they gave the volley, "These men are drunken with new wine." It was but a poor opposition to doctrine so powerful, I allow, but it was the best that could at that time be made, for we were obliged to retreat in much confusion, and leave the Christian fishermen masters of the field. As soon as we were a little recovered from the disorder into which that unexpected misfortune had plunged us, I summoned a council of war, in which the self-righteous Jews were the principal, next to our infernal train. I myself gave special orders that some method should be concerted effectually to destroy the name of Jesus, for, said I, if we let them alone, all the people will believe in their doctrine. In this council, it was resolved, to raise an army of those who were the greatest adversaries to the name of Jesus, to whom orders should be given to kill, destroy, and cause to perish all who believed in this way, till the Christian religion should be banished from the face of the earth. This army was raised, and the command given to Saul of Tarsus, at that time a mighty zealous for us, and who for a season made a dreadful havoc of all that believed contrary to the faith of the priests, for it ought to be observed, that the opinion of the priests has been esteemed true orthodoxy and the only faith, in all ages and countries. But here another sad disappointment and loss befell me, for as this same Captain Saul was on his march to Damascus to fight a pitched battle with the Christians, it so fell that Emmanuel himself was taking a tour in the valley to see how the pomegranates budded, and falling in with trusty Saul on his journey, unveiled his own personal excellencies to him, and laid him under an immediate arrest. As soon as he saw the beauties of Emmanuel, he felt the most sincere esteem for his person, and conceived the most exalted sentiments of friendship and love. Yea, he was even so much grieved that ever he had drawn his sword against him, but he renounced the service of 42 infidels on the spot, took the oath of allegiance to Jesus, and thenceforward hated my person and government with the most perfect hatred, and did what he could to overturn our state and subvert our government. Bookmark Farnese.a. Farnese, forgotten mystic amanuensis, to Francesco. A Wanderer in the Spirit Lands, by Francesco, through amanuensis Farnese. With a Farnese, we encroach upon a word, which was often used in the 19th century to describe a person who had a special relationship with one particular soul in the spirit world who would show them visions of the afterlife and teach them regarding the laws and mechanisms of the world beyond. A. Farnese was one of these, although there were quite a few. One of the more well known of these was Philos the Tibetan, whose work A Dweller on Two Planets is kept in print by a small following even today, though it was written by amanuensis, Yolgoro, in the 19th century, as well. In this better-known work, Philos tells the story of many of his lifetimes going back to the time of Atlantis and explains the mechanisms of karma. But in our forgotten mystic's work, the theme is the other life, the world beyond, and Francesco takes him on many journeys to this world and teaches him about the laws that abide within it. As with many of our forgotten mystics, not much is known about his life. He left a short note about the nature of his work in his work A Wandering in the Spirit World, which is also known by the title A Wanderer in the Spirit Lands. The following narrative was written more than a year ago, and in giving it to the public I do not claim to be its author, since I have only acted the part of an amanuensis and endeavored to write down as truthfully and as carefully as I could the words given to me by the spirit author himself, who is one of several spirits who have desired me to write down for them their experiences in the spirit world. I have had to write the words as fast as my pen could travel over the paper, and many of the experiences described and opinions advanced are quite contrary to what I myself believed to be in accordance with the conditions of life in the world of spirits. The spirit author Francesco I have frequently seen materialized, and he has been recognized on these occasions by friends who knew him in earth life. Having given the narrative to the public as I received it from the spirit author, I must leave with him all responsibility for the opinions expressed and the scenes described. All that is known about what brought Farnese to the transformation into mystichood is written in two accounts he included in his writings. 1. My death, and 2. My second death. My death. I have been a wanderer through a far country, in those lands that have no name, no place, for you of earth, and I would set down as briefly as I can my wanderings, that those whose feet are pointed to that bourne may know what may, in their turn, await them. On earth and in my life of earth I lived as those do who seek only how the highest point of self-gratification can be reached,